You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. We are so excited tonight about our panel, four veteran Los Angeles crime writers discussing the genre they love and the stories that keep them up at night. Trapped men and women, passions and desperate circumstances leading to violent ends, lurking intruders in the middle of the night. We Murders That You Don't Have To, a great title. We thank Mark Haskell-Smith for that. The whole panel does. And our moderator this evening is Paula L. Woods, and she will be speaking with Gar Anthony Haywood, Naomi Hirahara, and Mark Haskell-Smith. And I will give you very brief introductions to their illustrious careers. Gar Anthony Haywood is the Seamus and Anthony Award-winning author of 11 crime novels and numerous short stories. Booklist has called him a writer who has always belonged in the upper echelon of American crime fiction. His most recent novel is Cemetery Road, and his next thriller, Assume Nothing, will be published in December. Naomi Hirahara is the Edgar Award-winning author of the Mas Arai mystery series, which features a Japanese-American gardener and atomic bomb survivor who solves crimes. The novels in the series include Summer of the Big Bakai, Gasa Gasa Girl, Snakeskin Shamisen, and Blood Hina. And Mark Haskell-Smith is the author of four novels, Moist, Delicious, Salty, and Baked, and that's four different novels. His novels have been published in the UK, France, Italy, Norway, and Russia, and he's currently working on the nonfiction book Heart of Dankness, Underground Botanists, Outlaw Farmers, and The Race to the Cannabis Cup, which will hopefully be out next year. And Paula L. Woods, our moderator, is the author of the acclaimed Charlotte Justice mystery series, including the forthcoming Smiling Faces. She's also the editor of the critically acclaimed anthology Spooks, Spies, and Private Eyes, Black Mystery, Crime, and Suspense Fiction of the 20th Century, which was nominated for an Anthony Award. After the panel discussion, we're going to open it up to you for questions. So please wait until the microphone comes to you as we do record for podcast. And afterwards, our authors will all be signing their books in the lobby, and the books are for sale tonight, courtesy of our library store. And just a reminder that if you purchase books here at the library, you are also supporting the library with your purchase. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guests, and have a great evening. Thank you.
Thanks, Louise. Before we start the conversation, let's get our blood circulating, okay? Not a bad thing to do when we're talking about murder. So the first thing I want you to do is I want everyone to stand up who has read a crime novel, one crime novel, in the last 12 months. Stand up. All right.
And the rest of you can leave.
No. Stay standing.
My husband is still seated.
I think mine is too. No. Okay, if you've read between 2 and 5, I want you to stay standing. If you haven't, sit down. In the last year. Okay? Has anyone read 6 or more in the last year? All right, so here are our hardcore fans, and thank you so much. We wanted to get a sense of who was out there and what you're reading.
I thought it'd be a prize for whoever had read the most.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I want you to do something for me. I want you to, those of you who have read crime fiction, I want you to sit and think for a minute about why do you read crime fiction? Is it because you enjoy solving a puzzle? Is it because you were entranced by the Hardy Boys or by Agatha Christie or Nancy Drew as a small child? Does reading mysteries keep you from killing off your boss or your spouse or that guy who cut you off in traffic coming over here tonight? Or does crime fiction allow you to take a no consequences walk on the dark side? Okay? And for those of you who don't read crime fiction, I want to ask you why. Is it because you think crime fiction is somehow not serious? Is it different than literary fiction? Are you a closeted crime fiction reader? Are you someone who kind of like sneaks the crime book into the book bag and covers it with the wrapper or the dust jacket of a Man Booker Prize winning book to make yourself feel, you know, a little bit better?
You are going to work your way around to asking us a question.
No, I want them to think, because we're going to come back to them, okay? But we know that murder and mayhem are real, and they have real consequences for victims in our society, and we all take it seriously. After all, we're putting ourselves out there and putting crime out there and talking about what is in essence evil. And so my first question for you, Gar, is what do you get out of writing crime? Why do you murder?
I love doing panels with Paula, and I always make a point of taking this seat right next to her, because I take her notes and I go, I'm not answering that one. Forget that one right now. That's out of the question. But that first one actually wasn't too bad. You know, I've said all along, I always view myself as a reader more than a writer. I read since I was 7 years old. I still read within genre and without. So I write because the book I want to read doesn't exist, and I want to read it. And the writers on the panel will appreciate this, that as soon as you write it, then you don't want to read it anymore. And you end up reading it like 17 times. But it's just the genre that I grew the most familiar with. I got the most enjoyment out of. I think that on a kind of superficial level, you know, crime fiction gives us an opportunity to see how the world really should work out if all things were equal. And even though that's just an illusion, it's an enjoyable one, you know. And I get a kick out of writing about crimes that end well as opposed to how they do in the real world more often than not.
Okay. Naomi, what about for you?
Well, I'm a member of an endangered species, and it's not a published author, but it's being formally working at a newspaper. And I worked at a newspaper called the Rafu Shimpo. It's a Japanese, Rafu is the old name for LA. And it, this newspaper is Japanese American. It was a daily when I worked there, and it's not far from here in Little Tokyo. And it was established in 1903. Not that it was around in 1903, but it was located right next to Skid Row. And I wasn't on the fast track of journalism. I didn't take all these high-profile internships. So after graduating from college, that's probably why I was working at the Rafu Shimpo. And one of my first jobs was writing about a dead body in a swimming pool. And since I wasn't that experienced, it was only 6 inches, so that really dates me that I'm, you know, I'm measuring my stories. So it took me all day to write that story. But I think there's a lot of former journalists like Denise Hamilton and Michael Connelly, not that I'm putting myself in that exact category, but we're trained at the newspaper and we wrote a lot about crime. And I think, and then I also saw that I think there was two aspects of it. It's so interesting about people's agendas. Mm. Like, for instance, there was a co-ed that was killed in Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And, of course, her boyfriend was the one who was leading, trying to find the killer. And naturally, he was the one who did it. And so while I was working there, you learn to be very suspicious of people's intentions. And I find that fascinating. So that's why I write mysteries, because I'm really curious what's underneath all of you, your smiling faces out there.
I like that. And also I think journalists have that power of observation. And when you talk about journalists who write crime fiction, you know, one of the things I think as a group you're all very good at is that telling detail. Mark, what about for you?
Well, you know, I'd just like to start by saying that all fiction, I think all drama, is a crime novel. All novels are crime novels of some kind, whether it's a crime of the heart or a small betrayal, anything like that. So basically, for me, what I do is I kind of turn it up to 11. I like writing crime stories because I think criminals are fascinating, and they're also extreme characters because they're living outside of our society and outside of our laws, and they kind of have their own sort of weird moral compass. Mm-hmm. And I just find that fascinating and compelling. But I think the more novels I write, the less sort of obvious crime stories I'm getting into, and more they're like little sort of weird perversions than the characters, not the books, that interest me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Can I add real quickly, because what Mark said is right, that when we read about real crimes and the people that commit them, what we really want to know is, what could make a person do that thing,
And chop that's off that penis and put it in the garbage disposal.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
And her answer, he deserved it?
Yeah, well, see, we get to elaborate a little bit more, on her reasonings. And I think that's part of the fun, at least for me, is I get to answer that question every time I sit down and write a book is, what made this person do this terrible thing?
Or the other side of it is what really happens. I remember being on jury duty once, and the case was, we acquitted the guy, and one woman was hanging up the jury because she said, well, I don't know what really happened. And it's like, well, you don't get to know what really happened. The tip-off for me was she had a Dennis Lehane book under her arm the whole time she was talking about it. It's like, okay, I understand where you... But that's the other thing crime fiction does, is that it gives you the answer to things that you can't really know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's interesting. Last night, I don't know if any of you saw this, John Banville was on Charlie Rose. Did any of you see that last night? Banville is a man Booker Prize winner, right, for The Sea. And he was talking about himself as Banville and how when he writes literary fiction, he writes with a pen and he's, worrying over every sentence. And when he writes Benjamin Black, and he's written several, of those
which are
crime novels, yes. He just knocks them out in 4 months on a typewriter. It's like, psh, done. And it was sort of condescending. It was condescending. You think? And I'm wondering how you respond to that notion that somehow crime fiction is less than literary fiction.
Are you looking at me?
I'm looking at anybody who's willing to take it on.
Well, the fact is there is a lot of genre books out there that aren't very well written. And there's a lot of literary fiction novels that aren't very well written. The fact is you don't hear about those that much, but... The one thing that's great about mystery readers and thriller readers is they read a lot of books. I mean, they're voracious readers. And so their publishers publish a lot of those books. And unfortunately, they just kind of gets this sort of stigma attached to it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Because there are some really crappy mysteries out there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not anyone on this panel, but.
Yeah, I guess the notion, though, that somehow just by writing a crime novel, you're less than, or somehow it's less than anything else.
But that's like his problem. That seems like his ego is talking about, when I'm do my serious writing,
right.
I write seriously, but when I do my frivolous writing, I write frivolously. And that, to me, is just like a bunch of, bullshit.
Malarkey.
Malarkey, thank you. Baloney.
But maybe, should we judge it by how much time it takes? Maybe it's an asset that he's just letting the story, flow through him.
Right.
On the page.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I think we're concerned about stories.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's our emphasis.
Yeah.
I wonder how much crime fiction he actually reads. That would be my first impulse would be to ask him, well, this is how you create crime fiction, but how much do you actually read? If you have that, such a low opinion of the quality of crime fiction, because I know that some of the people, Mark's absolutely right that, like any genre or subgenre, the vast majority, I guess, of crime fiction is not all that great. Certainly not literary quality, but there are some writers that write within the field that I would, put up against anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, on a sentence by sentence level, really good writing is really good writing, whether the story is about a murder or anything,
Absolutely. I think on the other hand, mysteries are also a lot of fun. And Mark, when I think fun, Gar, I'll come to you later. But
no,
when,
that's all right.
When I think, well, you're marginally
fine. Find me fun as us.
Well, I understand.
You're too hard-boiled, man. You're too.
But with you, Mark, I mean, you have this ability to write funny, and as you say, to write about people on those margins, and at the same time to tell a really good story. And what for you makes that exciting? What do you think about when you come to the page to write a moist or to write about the cannabis cup and in Baked? I mean, what was that like for you?
Well, to write about the cannabis cup, that took a lot of specialized research.
Maybe you ought to maybe you ought to explain what the cannabis cup is, by the way.
Oh, there's every year around Thanksgiving in Amsterdam, there is a contest of who grows or develops the best pot. And people come from all over the world, and there's all these botanists and sort of scientific, quasi-scientific guys and growers. And there are some really interesting characters, which is why I then wrote a nonfiction book about it. But for me, you know, I get an idea for a character, and it's really just about following that character through the world, and the story kind of unfolds. A lot of it's just finding a really interesting character and getting them in a pickle.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the same thing, I like sweat the sentences as much and the words as much as, you know, anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I think that all that stuff is really important to, because when you write a novel, you're creating a world. So every single word, every single image that you bring into it is about making that world as rich and vibrant and exciting as you can. And so that's what I try to do.
Well, it's all about the quality of the read.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
I don't see how that changes from one author to the next, regardless of what they're writing. I think we're all, you know, attempting to create the best, most entertaining read
mm-hmm.
that we can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I think for you, Gartz, it's interesting because you've written across several series. You've written standalones. You've written comic with the Loudermilks, and you've written in Cemetery Road. You know, reviews have said that it borders on Greek tragedy in terms of being that coming of age novel, and it really is a very wise book. I mean, where do you find your comfort zone across all of those different ways of writing about crime?
Oh, that's a good question. That you got me on that one. no, really, the good questions are the ones that you just don't have a snappy comeback to. I think I'm always in search of my comfort level. You know, I think that trial and error is part of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, all of us have a manuscript or two or three or four that, you know, is in a drawer somewhere because we thought we could find our comfort level with it and we didn't.
Do you think Cemetery Road, the character in Cemetery Road, is the kind of guy he is because of the kind of life experiences you've had as well?
Absolutely, at least in part. You know,
Not a book you could have written when you were 22.
No way. Handy White is roughly my age. He's in his mid-50s.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's looking back on his life, you know, with the kind of perspective that I think I'm bringing to the table when I look at mine. So that's definitely a book of its time in terms of where I was in my life
mm-hmm.
and what I'd been able to experience up to this point. I couldn't have written it 25 years ago, and I wouldn't have wanted to. It
mm-hmm.
wouldn't have been the
wouldn't
kind
have been
of
interesting
it wouldn't have been
you.
Interesting
yeah.
to me. And I would have known fairly early on, you know, 2-3 chapters in, that I don't have what it takes to write this book. Fortunately, I think I have what it takes to write it now.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I could do it again or would we even want to, you know, remains to be seen.
You know, Naomi, I think about you in that regard because, you know, Gar's writing a book of a man approximately at his stage in life, and yet you have such a different path with Maserai and your series. So can you talk a little bit about writing about an elderly Japanese gardener and how you came to that and what you're able to do through his eyes?
Well, it just so happens my father is Japanese-American, and he happens to be a gardener, and he's also an A-bomb survivor.
Mm.
So he inspired the character, but he's not Maserai. Sometimes I like Maserai better, and sometimes not. But I think my alter ego is actually an old cranky guy. You know, I think secretly I want to be just out there and, you know, and not be like a nice Japanese girl sometimes. So I think that's some of the
bit
fantasy.
Of an, a bit of an outlaw?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So, you know, it's funny. When I was in high school, we had moved to from Altadena to South Pasadena, which is a wealthier area, and I didn't want people to know my dad was a gardener. And one time I couldn't go to like the ski trip, and I told my mom, you know, why does dad have to be a gardener? And she usually didn't stick up for him, but you know, I knew in this moment that I had erred. And because of that, my husband teases me. He goes, just for that one comment, Naomi, you have to make your dad this hero of this whole series. So I have this guilt complex. But I just feel because he's born here but raised in Japan, they call the certain category of person, language is not his strong suit in either English or Japanese. So I just feel like he doesn't have a way to these type of people don't have a way to really express themselves, yet they've had this incredible experience of surviving the atomic bomb. So they have a story to tell. Mm. So that's why I wanted to use the amateur sleuth model. And actually a lot of Chester Himes and Walter Mosley and actually Gar's work as well was inspirational to figure out how to use the mystery genre to make commentary on social issues and community.
And you do a lot of that. I mean, you also have a very strong historical aspect to all of your books. And was that a natural love you had of history?
Yes, most definitely.
Yeah, see, it was that for me too. I think having studied Black history when I was in college, writing about a detective gave me a way to like explore that history one way or another. Yeah, absolutely. Gar, so tell me something.
We skipped Mark.
Well, no, we're not. We didn't skip Mark. We've talked to
we've
Mark.
We've talked.
Oh, you don't. You just want me to skip you. That's what it is. Okay, Mark. Let's.
Can
go
he
to
read
you.
Ahead? It's a really tough question.
No. Here's the question I have for both of you. Actually, you've both written for television, and written film treatments, etc. And I'm wondering, from your standpoint, what is there about writing for film and writing books that feed each other? Do you think that having that that cinematic eye as you're writing in television or in film helps you when you're writing your books, and do writing books help you as you're telling your stories in that genre?
You want to take that first?
Yeah, I'll go. Well, I worked as a screenwriter for about 16 years, and I had a couple of movies made, and I, you know, did a lot of script doctor work. If you ever saw a movie about a big snake that eats people in the rainforest, that was one of mine. But here's how Hollywood helped me become a novelist. I got so tired of studio executives saying, well, this story's a little too dark for us, but we really like the writing. How about this idea about a dog who's a psychiatrist, and people come and they walk him and he helps solve their problems? And finally I was like, you know what? I'm just going to write a book. I like to read books. How hard could it be? Right. Well, you know, it's beginner's luck.
You found out, right?
I found out how hard it was, but it was kind of like that sort of naivete that I had actually was kind of helped propel me. I didn't know I was making mistakes, so I just finished a book, which is Moist.
Okay.
And so Hollywood really helped me a lot because it just I became fed up with it, and it's great. sometimes you have to reach that point where you're just like, okay, fine. I'll go take my ball and go play somewhere else.
Well, Gar, you came to it in the opposite manner. You were writing fiction before you wrote for television.
Right.
So how did one influence the other in your case?
Well, I wasn't getting paid writing fiction, so I thought maybe if I wrote some TV, I might actually see a paycheck. So that was the first impulse. But in terms of, you know, what one, you know, assists me to do the other, and in what ways, I think all screenwriting, all good screenwriting, certainly, brevity, you know, is always big. You know, get in, get out, this kind of thing. And I've sort of learned to do that in my fiction because of that. I was reading Joseph Finder. Does anybody read Joseph Finder?
Yeah.
He's a thriller writer that's very popular right now. I hadn't read him before. And you're always curious to know, you know, people that find success in what we in the business that we're in, you know, exactly what are they doing right? Mm-hmm. You know, you sort of dissect it. And one of the things I found in his books that I really, really appreciate is his dialogue just flies like this, and his dialogue really tells the story. Mm-hmm. And I think he has a screenwriting background.
Right.
And so I think he's an example of, you know, what I think I learned in writing screenplays and for television is that, you know, get in, get out every scene, and let the dialogue just flow naturally and quickly to assist you as your story goes along.
Okay.
Well, dialogue is character, right?
Absolutely.
Particularly in any of the forms.
Absolutely. I think it's deadly to read page and page after page of exposition that's just explaining things. And, you know, let's get to the action.
Are you listening, Naomi?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm taking notes right now.
Are you taking notes, Naomi?
I'll listen to the podcast.
Naomi, tell us about Blood Hina. Hina. Tell us about Blood Hina.
Well, Moss, he has a best friend, Haruo. And one thing, Haruo and Moss are both A-bomb survivors, but Haruo has this terrible scar on his face. And that's something telling. I didn't necessarily do this very consciously, but Moss is the only one, like he has a veteran friend who was with the All-Nisei, All-Japanese-American unit, who's missing a finger. And but Moss is perfectly fine on the outside. So he's dealing with the inner demons. So that's part of it. But anyway, his best friend's getting married. And there's what I usually start, because I'm writing a very idiosyncratic book. You know, why does this Japanese-American gardener solve crimes that the LAPD, he's in New York in one of the books, NYPD can't solve? And it really starts with the clue. So what is it at the crime scene that Moss sees and knows from his being a Japanese-American gardener that allows him to solve it? And here it's Hina is, it's like princess. Mm-hmm. This is a Japanese doll display. Is every March 3rd they put it up, and that's missing. But it takes place, I actually use a lot of my nonfiction research. I did a book on the Southern California Flower Market, which is not far from here. And that's like one of, and did you know there's actually two markets? They're opposite each other. And one is called, referred to as the American Market, and the other one across the street is the Japanese Market. Uh-huh. Although they're both very multicultural in terms of the tenants. But so I find ways, so that's, it takes place, a lot of it, in the flower market and talks about that business. Mm-hmm. So, and there's parts that go into Imperial Valley, and there's drugs involved as well.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And there, there's
you and Mark can talk about that.
Right. And there's like, yeah, murders in the past.
Okay.
It's kind of a...
Gar, we started to talk about Cemetery Road and how you what you brought to that as a mature writer and a mature person. Tell us a little bit about the book, though, and what propels the book.
Well, Cemetery Road, it's told in first person from the perspective of a guy named Handy White, who in his youth, when he was like 19 or 20 years old, he and two buddies, they lived in Los Angeles, and for kicks they committed crimes. They were thieves, essentially, and they never hurt anybody, never got caught, didn't have police records of any kind. And for strictly personal reasons, Handy convinced them all to pull one final job that went very, very bad. Mm-hmm. And it went so bad that they decided that they couldn't see each other anymore. And they went their separate ways. Handy moved to St. Paul, Minnesota. And the other two friends stayed here in L.A. And 26 years later, one of the two friends that remains in L.A. winds up dead. He's shot numerous times, and his body's found in the trunk of a car down by the Santa Monica Pier. And Handy is called by the guy's widow to come to the funeral. And Handy is utterly convinced that this guy's murder has something to do with the crime they committed that went wrong. Mm. He's been living with the guilt of that crime and the fear that payback is just around the corner for it ever since. And so when he comes to L.A. for the funeral, he basically decides to stay to find out if, in fact, his old friend's murder involves the crime that they committed and whether or not he'll be next, you know, to die. So that's the criminal aspect of the story. The, you know, the more personal aspect of it for me is the man's a father. He's got a grown daughter. Their relationship is on the rocks. He has to try to hold that together. She's still in Minnesota, and he, while he's out here trying to work the investigation, his amateur investigation. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things going on besides the criminal aspect mm-hmm. of Cemetery Road. But again, it's a book that took forever to write because it took forever for me to feel my way through it. And I'm very proud of it, to be mm-hmm. frank with you. You know.
Well, it's gotten great reviews, and I having read it in the Loudermilk books and the Gunner series, it's a different kind of book. It's much more mature. It's not so procedural.
I like to think I'm more mature, Paul. But this panel may, I guess, the podcast of this panel may
prove otherwise.
May prove otherwise.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting that you were able to. Sorry, there's a bug here. I think it's just interesting you're able to create in that character someone who's not only investigating a crime, but is also dealing with his own guilt and dealing with the fact that he's anticipating there's this retribution that's right out there for him. I think a lot of people at a certain point in their life realize that the sins that they've committed in their lives or the wrongs that they've done one way or another, the chickens come home to roost.
And I think people, you know, they would secretly want closure, mm-hmm. you know, and all these open wounds that they've left behind. You know, they want to know, you know, if in fact they're going to have to pay for their mm-hmm. their former sins and sleep better at night.
Yeah, well, to me, that's the interesting, you know, thing about writing about murders. I mean, you know, there's a lot of books that where murders, there's a high body count and it's like, ha, 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 the chocolate brownie murders or whatever.
Right.
But if, you know, when someone, if you really think about it in a real way, in the real world, when someone is murdered, that is like a big thing. It's the most extreme thing people can do, right? So that's why it becomes a good jumping off point for drama. But it's like all that sort of guilt and the things that haunt you and the regrets or the fears that you have. It's Patricia Highsmith in the Ripley series explores, or in Strangers on a Train, really explores it well. And Cemetery Road is about that too. And I think that that's what kind of can elevate crime fiction into this sort of really interesting world where you're looking at like extreme behaviors, but also this mm-hmm. the psychology behind it and kind of the real world, real emotions, real things that people go through when they do stuff. It's not always about, you know, hiding the body in Griffith Park.
Right, right. Well, and to some
extent, not that that's not a good place to hide a body, because it totally is.
Where specifically would you? Yeah. You want to give us any clues, yeah. Mark?
No, I'm taking notes.
I think the old zoo is good.
Ah. You know, it's interesting you say that, because I think one of the things that we think about when we're writing crime fiction is not just the emotions, but also how does it connect to reality? Whether it's something that's a real crime that's happened that you begin to think, well, what would happen if I were the victim's sister, or what would happen if I perpetrated that crime? And it kind of takes you down that path. And I'm wondering for each of you, do you look a lot at what happens around you in terms of the environment, child disappearances? There's a great book I'm reading right now by Megan Abbott called The End of Everything that's about a child abduction. Mm-hmm. And it's told from the perspective of the victim's best friend. Mm-hmm. Okay, and it's a lot about regret and what did I see and what did I not see. Right. So I'm wondering, are there times that real events spark that desire to tell a story?
I got one, because in Baked, there's a character who is this kind of Irish Salvadoran homicidal maniac, but.
Could you say that again?
He's a half Irish, half Salvadoran, a homicidal maniac, but he's based on a real guy. I used to live in Atwater Village when this guy Timothy McGeehee went on a shooting spree. He killed 8 people that they know about. They think the police think he maybe killed 12 people in basically a 6-month span. Wow. And when you were living with that, and it was literally, he's like, a guy's watering his lawn, he gets shot. A guy's painting down at the LA River, he gets shot. A kid was skateboarding, a little 16-year-old shot. This guy was, he called them hunting parties. He was just a maniac. So it was kind of like, I'd go to get bread at the bakery. I'd say to my kids, I hope daddy comes back. I mean, and that's how everyone felt. It was terrifying that
this
guy was
like
running.
It's kind of like the DC murders.
It's Son of Sam, too.
Yeah. And it was just this weird, it didn't get a lot of play in greater LA, but in Atwater, where the shootings were happening, where everyone was freaked out. And so for me, I put it in Baked because I needed to kind of process what was that. You know, I wanted to like explore what that was like to remind myself and then, you know, get it out of my system a little bit. Mm-hmm. And of course, he got captured like all homicidal maniacs, shirtless in Arizona in a trailer park. And he's on death row now, but it was a, you know, that's a real world thing. I don't normally put real world stuff in my books, but mm-hmm. that was like really strong, you know.
Naomi, has that ever happened for you? Has there been something that's happened in the real world that you needed to process and it ended up in one of your books?
I think in terms of the killing, and I think it's a delicate balance. I don't know, did you all see that AMC series, The Killing? And I loved it at first, but then it was so agonizing because it was trying to realistically depict these parents whose daughter had been killed. And it was just, week after week, and you feel like you're, you know, being wrung out. And when I really think of, because I'm writing an amateur sleuth story, and there's always that danger of why are so many people dying in this person's life, right? The Murder, She Wrote kind of situation. But the sad thing is, when I really think about it, I have known a lot of people who have been killed, you know, and I don't know if it's just a function of our times, if it's being in L.A., but when I knew the woman who had been killed in Westwood, it was a stray bullet, remember, of the gang shooting?
Yes, yes.
And there's another acquaintance shortly thereafter in Gardena who had been killed, you know, by a stray bullet. It was mistaken identity. Mm-hmm. And I remember being in this car with, and there were the two victims happened to be Japanese American, and I was with the elders, the Japanese American elders, and they were looking at me and they go, I wonder who's next. You know? And it was really eerie. And this, we're not talking about, you know, gangbanger community, you know, and it's just a function of our world, you know. But I think it's delicate, you know, one thing, no one says that. Naomi, your books are funny, but there's parts of it I read, I go, that's kind of funny. And I think it's, to me, there's a balance. Mm-hmm. There needs to, because we are trying to entertain people as well. So it has to be the adrenaline rush or the amusement of the characters, or there needs to be a little bit of a balance.
Because, you know, think about those, I forget who writes the series, but there's a series of books where the main character is a caterer. And every time she caters a wedding or something, someone dies. I'm like, who would hire her after, after like five or six of those?
Well, Gar, how did you deal with that with the Loudermilks? You did what, a couple of Loudermilk books?
Two.
Yeah, and they're a retired couple in the Gulf Stream, was it?
No, it's the Airstream.
Airstream.
They're stylish.
Yeah, they're a styling couple. Yeah.
So how did you deal with that as amateurs who get caught up in crime?
Well, since the series only lasted two books, I didn't really have a problem with up with storylines. Let's put it that way.
Was that a reason why you didn't do more, or was it?
The publisher decided they didn't want any more, and I was ready to move on at that time. Anyway, it was more the Loudermilks, frankly, was more of an experiment than anything else. I was just trying to see if I could be funny, and obviously, I can't. So.
Actually, the books are very funny.
Books are really funny.
Yeah, they were really funny.
But it's, you know, but since you asked the question on the serious side, you know, those types of books, I think they are on the far end of farce. You know, where you basically have a contract with the reader that says this world's not real. Mm-hmm. These people, you know, are more ridiculous than anybody you'll ever meet in your lifetime. The situation's just. Don't even think about, you know, how this happened. Because
right.
You know, so you're playing a game, and it's understood, and so you don't really worry that much about whether something's credible or not.
Right,
you know,
right.
You just go with it.
Although I think you still have to have some internal rules. I mean,
I love comic novels.
Get
but...
paid. That's my most. that's what I've learned over the years. That's my first rule. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but you know, you've got a contract with the reader, but at the same time, you can't all of a sudden, like, what's the old adage about when things get slow, just have a guy come into the room with a gun?
No.
Sometimes that doesn't work.
No, put something hardcore right there.
Oh, is
that's
that right?
That's what Gary Phillips says. Like, when things get slow, he's like, put something hardcore right there.
I've noticed that about his writing now that you mentioned that. No, you're right. What you're saying is that, you know, it still has to function as a mystery.
Right.
You know, regardless of how entertaining or how silly or ridiculous the story is, readers still want you to play by a certain, you know, number of rules. And you can't break those rules because it's not playing fair.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in terms of, you know, giving the reader the proper clues and coming up with a resolution that adds up in the end,
right,
you still have to do all those things. But ultimately you're writing about a 50-something black couple, you know, who retired early on, God knows what kind of money, buying an $88,000 Airstream trailer and evading five kids that are driving them nuts. You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that's very real world. I could be wrong about that, but that's I called myself creating a fantasy when I wrote
mm-hmm.
those.
Mm-hmm. And how do you contrast with the grittier books? I mean, you tend to gravitate more toward, and I think you get a lot of acclaim for the books that have the depth, et cetera. And I'm, again, coming back to the question about, are any of those based in reality or based in incidents or things that you've seen in your life or that you see on the news?
I've never been in the habit of, like, pulling things out of reality, out of the real world. I don't scan the newspaper every morning looking for something, you know, that I can base another story on. Occasionally something happens, you know, that, you know, might plant a seed.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of me ever taking anything almost...
None of that ripped from the headlines.
No, nothing like, ripped from
yeah.
the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I was thinking earlier when you asked that question was occasionally, and this is funny because it falls right into place with the title Mark came up with for this panel. Occasionally there is somebody that you just really want to kill. You know, you just... you want to kill them. And so I think the most obvious case of that for me was one of the Gunner books. I think it was When Last Seen Alive. When I was writing that book, there was an African-American female radio host, a talk show hostess on, I think it was KABC.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't mean to inject politics into this discussion. Please forgive me. But this woman was essentially the...
If
Rush Limbaugh were black and female, this is pretty much
female Larry Elder.
She would sound like.
Mm-hmm.
I think she'd be worse. She was worse than Larry Elder, you know, by the way I measure these things. But anyway, for some sick reason, I used to listen to her, and and one day I'm in the car and I'm driving and I've said, okay, I'm either going to run my car into that pole or I'm killing this woman in a book. It's just one or the other. And I ended up killing her in a book.
So. I love it. You know, it's interesting. When I've killed people off, I usually write bios of my victims mm-hmm. so I know who they are and what their life story is.
It feels better that way.
Yeah, yeah. No, but for myself. I mean, it never makes it into print, but that's just my research.
It still feels better that way.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But even so, killing them off is difficult. I mean, when you kill... So for me, when I kill someone off, it's like I've created this person, I've created a reason they existed in the world, and now I've decided to kill them off. And what does that do? I mean, what does that do to the people who surround them? What does that do to the people investigating it, et cetera? So it's not so much like, oh, I just don't like this person and I'm just going to like kill them off in a book. Mm. Because by the time you've created that character and then kill them off, there are consequences.
Right.
So you got to know, you know, what that's all about.
Well, it goes back to, I'll let you guys comment on this, but that goes back to what Mark said earlier in that, you know, what we're really trying to write are books that deal with the real world ramifications yeah. of violent, you know, violent crime. There are other authors. Obviously, the Loudermilk books would be a perfect example of a subgenre type of book that, you know, doesn't much care about, you know,
right.
those real world right. ramifications. But the by and large, the stuff that we write, that's what we're most interested in. It's like, yeah, there's a dead body on the floor, but what happens now? Mm-hmm. You know, what does that body actually mean, and what did that person leave behind?
Right, right.
I think for me, it's like, who's guilty? I have a problem sometimes because some of my books I don't outline it. I don't even know who killed the person until as I go along, and I'm going, no, don't let it be that person. And you kind of really, you know, and it just sort of unfolds.
It's unfurling right, in front of you. Right. Yeah. Mark, in your case, yours aren't always propelled by a whodunit.
I don't do the whodunit.
Yeah. So
I do the how and why and what WTF. Done it.
Right. So in your case, do you know from beginning to end how it's going to end?
No, I never know. I just start out. I have a character, and you know what's important is that every character has like a core desire. They have something they want or need. Or they want to get, and that's true with the antagonist too. So that everyone is after something, and oftentimes there are different things, but their paths intersect, and sometimes violence happens. And to me, that's what's interesting. So I never really outline. I kind of have a vague idea. You know, I like happy endings. Like, call me a sap, but that's true. But they're usually not happy. I would think, or you would expect.
How often do you know what the interconnections between the characters are going to be, or do those work themselves out as you go?
They work themselves out. You know, I like to just put characters in motion and know it's like that. It's like a demolition derby. They all start going the same direction, but eventually, you know, and then you just wait for them to hit. And then that's the first draft, right? And then the other revisions, you go through it again and again and again to make it like make sense and clarify things and stuff. But yeah,
Naomi, for you, as you're creating your characters, you have Moss and his circle, so the circle of gardeners and people that he knows, but who else gets included in that circle and why?
Yeah, and I have to be careful with that because you know, in terms of the reading public, they might not be that familiar with this world, and I have to be careful with names. You know, an early draft of my book, I had a character named Watanabe, which is a very common Japanese-American name, but people were saying Watanabe, and, you know, so, yeah, I think this was, where was it? Maybe in, I don't know, Colorado, Nebraska, or whatever. But so, you know, Arai, one of the reasons why I selected that name is it's kind of short.
And it's kind of easy, hard to mispronounce.
Right. Mm-hmm. But so, you know, I often what I end up doing is kind of collapsing characters because mm-hmm. that world starts to get too large.
Mm, okay.
So I have to be kind of calculating in that way.
Okay. Gar, what's next for you?
December, a book comes out that I finished some time ago entitled Assume Nothing, mm-hmm. which is a thriller about an ex-cop from Florida. Who his family was killed by a serial killer. And he had no idea who the guy was. It wasn't a personal vendetta or anything like that. The guy that killed his family was caught. There's closure. But he's a basket case. Can't be a cop anymore. He's totally ruined. So he moves to L.A., rebuilds his life, gets remarried, has a little boy. But as we find him in present day L.A., the marriage is on the rocks because this guy is hyper-protective of his new wife and his son. Nobody can breathe wrong, you know, on either one of them. And circumstances to conspire to connect him with four very bad guys who don't know his backstory. And they ended up threatening his new wife and his son. Oh, and
bad move.
Yeah, they basically light the fuse on him, and bad things happen after that.
Wow. And Naomi, for you, I know you, in addition to writing the series, you've also written books for middle grade.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that and where you're going with that.
Well, I took a break. I mean, I did something you're not supposed to do when you have a series. I wrote a book a year, three books in the series, and then I took a break. And I thought I was writing a woman's book, but it turned out, you know, my agent looked at it, she goes, there were some flashbacks, and she said, well, the 13-year-old's voice is stronger than the 30-something-year-old's voice. Mm. I think you have a YA. And I didn't necessarily want to write a YA. I go, oh no, I have a YA. What is this? You know.
Is there something I can take for it?
Huh? Yeah. But now I realize there's different categories, and I wrote a middle grade book, and we had to take her age down from 13 to 12.
Ah.
Mm. And it's called 1001 Cranes, and I love writing for that particular age. I'm not edgy enough. You guys could write for the YA crowd, but I'm middle grade is like a perfect fit for me. And it's kind of nice when I do programs, you know, to do it with children. It's really fun and to encourage reading. And this is interesting for the mystery crowd. Some publishers are recognizing that there's a demand for mysteries and thrillers for YA.
Yeah, you were telling me about that. Why don't you share that?
So Soho Press is going to have a new imprint called Soho Teen. And there's another one. They do more like independent kind of mystery books. And then another one, Harper Teen is trying to encourage, I guess, more straight-ahead mysteries and thrillers. So I think that's really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on one Masarai. It's dealing with strawberries, but I'm also working on another book for the middle grade market, and it's in this subgenre called steampunk, which is set like in the Victorian age or the
that's
turn
awesome.
Of the 20th century.
Yeah.
You have a title for that yet?
I'm not going to say right now. Right. But if you search enough, you could find the working title. But,
okay.
Yeah. I have a feeling you're going to, at the end, you're going to go, oh, that title, how did I come there? Where did that come from?
I got to ask Mark for his ideas.
There you go. There you go.
Keep it short is my advice.
Yes.
And so, Mark, tell us a little bit about the nonfiction book. It's out in beginning of next year?
Yeah, May 5th is a pub date.
Ah, okay. Heart of Dankness.
Heart of Dankness. Underground botanists, outlaw farmers, and the race for the cannabis cup. Basically,
that's not that short.
That's not. I know. I'm trying to keep my nonfiction books with the longest possible titles ever.
So like, they'll know it's not fiction, right?
Right.
That's
so
not
like
moist.
Antarctica, lots of penguins. It's really cold, and it's at the bottom of the world. It'll be like, you know, my next. No, okay. For me, like, so when I was researching Baked and I learned about the Cannabis Cup and I went to Amsterdam and I saw it and I met these people there, the people who are like these underground botanists and the growers who grow this stuff, and they're fanatics and they're the most interesting, kind of wonderful, kooky people ever. And so I was telling my book agent about these people I met and she's like, so you think there's a nonfiction book there? And I was like, Yeah, because for me, it's like where hedonism and criminality intersect is like, that's my sweet spot right there for what I want to do. And so basically, I wrote a knock together proposal and sold it to Broadway Books and spent the last year, you know, going to Amsterdam or going up into the Sierras and just talking to these people. It was been really, really fun experience, because usually when you're writing a novel, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I'm in my bathrobe, in my big purple chair, you know, with my
laptop. I'm never wearing your bathrobe when I write.
and you don't get out much, you know, your grooming starts to fail. And anyway, so it's kind of nice to write nonfiction. You actually go talk to people, travel places, you eat food with them. It's really cool.
It has a whiff of Susie Orlean and the Orchid book. Yeah, that kind of obsessed characters who are after the gold, if you will.
Yeah, and it's and also because a lot of particularly ones working here in California, it's legal in California, but it's not legal in the United States. And last time I checked, California's part of the United States, so it becomes this real murky gray area where you can and cannot say stuff to people. And so what they do to get around all that, it's pretty fascinating. And I think you should all pick it up when it comes out. And
you know, before we turn this over to the audience and have them participate, I'm wondering how you feel about ebooks and tablet books and how that influences your readers or your relationship with readers and where you think all of that may be going in your work. Do you see yourself writing books that just get translated into that medium, or do you see that it might change how you write a book or what you do in a crime novel?
And we're frozen. And we're out.
Wasn't that one of the ones I crossed out?
No.
Here's my. I mean, I just write the story. I just follow the story, whatever it is, whether fiction or nonfiction, whatever interests me, I try to pursue it. And I think for readers, it's like, I don't care if you read it on your iPhone or in a paper book. I mean, this technology works pretty well and has for a long time. It doesn't matter. And anything that gets more people to read more, I think, is fantastic. So I that's my opinion.
It's interesting because there are some writers, I think Rick Riordan among them, who's been experimenting with, so if you write a crime novel or you're writing something for YA, for example, and you're doing it on a tablet, is it something that you can touch and all of a sudden you go to some ancillary part of the web to get information about cannabis growing in Amsterdam or the cannabis cup or what have you?
Well, that's really interesting because I just was talking to these ebook experts, and that those kind of hyperlinked interactive books is the one market of ebooks that are actually plummeting.
That's interesting.
Publishers were putting out more of them, and they just aren't selling, so they're pulling them back. People, when they want to read a book, you want to enter the world of the text. You don't want to have to turn the page and hear a jingle start because you're at a you know, Krispy Kreme. Oh, the Krispy Kreme jingle, you know.
I don't know. Still, I would actually buy the scratch and sniff version of your next book. So.
Heart of Dankness, you mean?
And we're working on that.
Okay.
You know, well, I hesitated to say something because I actually have been very glad about the ebook. I mean, if you write a series and if you're like more mid-list, like my books are not necessarily found in every Barnes & Noble.
Right.
And if there's some kind of news blip that encourages people to read the series, I mean, it is easier to go to their e-reader or whatever and download the book. So in some ways, it's very helpful, I think, for mid-list writers. It can be.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I was going to say, although with all the self-publishing, there's so many books coming out now, it's just like a lot of noise. You know?
Right, right. Well, and the advantage is that you don't have to carry all those books around. You end up with one of these and you've got hundreds of them, you know, right at your fingertips. Mm. So, yes, sir. Sure. We're going to open it up for questions. I asked you some questions in the beginning about why you read crime fiction and what does it mean for you, and we've got a question down here.
I have a quickie two-parter.
Okay.
Besides wanting to thank you so much for that intriguing title for this program, it just got me down here. The two-parters, there's yesterday was the birthday of the screenwriter of West Side Story and Gypsy, and Lawrence commented, I find people so much more interesting in the virtual world that I create than the real world where I find people are basically boring. So I'd be interested in your comment on that. And then secondly, I'm a great aficionado of Peter Falk's Columbo, some of you may know. You learn about the murder beforehand, but it takes him a while to finesse the truths out of the people, and I did have an opportunity to meet Peter Falk, and he was an amazing guy. So I wonder if any of you have ever thought of revealing the truth that normally would come at the end, at the beginning, and work itself backwards.
Okay.
Two of my books start with they open with the murder and then the whole rest of the book is why'd they do that? You know, so I didn't realize I was doing Columbo.
Yeah, and your question about real world characters versus fictional characters, my husband teases me sometimes when I'm writing. He says I'm in Charlottesville, and Charlottesville is one of those places where I can control all those people. So certainly, to the extent that people do and behave in ways that you have some control over, might be better than people you can't control. But I don't know if I'd say that it's that the real world is disappointing. I don't know about you, for you, Naomi.
I actually find real, that's why I don't use real crime stories, because a lot of times I think they're so fantastic and crazy, like no one would believe it if you wrote it in a novel. But back to Columbo, I love Columbo. And I think he was kind of an inspiration for me to create my character in terms of the underestimated sleuth. And also he drives around in a rundown car, and I love that.
Yeah, I think that if all of us here found, you know, real world people fascinating enough, we would write nonfiction, you know. So, you know, the reason we write fiction is because the real world is just not big and crazy enough to suit us, you know, and the people in it, you know, that goes for them too. And I confess I'm a huge Columbo fan. I've always loved Columbo, and I actually met him myself when we was doing the ABC version of the two-hour movies. I actually got in to pitch, you know, hoping to get write an episode, and didn't work out, but I got to meet him, so that was exciting.
I think it's interesting, though, we talk about controlling our characters, you know, compared to the real world, but then the novelist's job is to make the characters seem as real as possible.
Yep.
Absolutely. You know,
because, yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
I have to confess that I'm one of the people who does not read crime fiction, but I'm here because I love listening to writers, and I write a little myself. My question to you is, I mean, one of the reasons why I don't read crime fiction is because I find it disturbing to spend time with evil people. It infects my dreams. Imagery stays with me for way longer than I care to. I'd rather be in a world where people are good. So my question to you is, as writers, you spend so much of your time inside the heads of evil people. What do you do to, I mean, do you become depressed? Do you become disturbed? And what do you do to counter?
All of the above. That's all.
Well, you know, I think that there are some crime fiction that, like, you know, if you look at like the Hannibal Lecter kind of books that are really disturbing. I don't read books about serial killers myself for the exact same reasons, but you know, I don't really think that I can only speak for my own characters, but I don't really, sometimes they do bad things, but they're not really evil. They're more kind of misunderstood, and you always understand in the novel why they're, for them, it's
perfectly. You sound like their mother.
I am a little bit. Because they
were abused as children.
No, there's not, no, and there's no sick granny that they have to get money for. But, you know, you really, when you're reading the books, you understand why they're doing what they're doing. So you can kind of feel some empathy for them. Because if a character is just purely evil, that's a two-dimensional character. That's not a real character.
Exactly.
I was thinking about Hannibal Lecter. That was a good example. I mean, that's a movie that, like, that was the end of one of those kind of movies.
Yeah, no. And I'm with you on that. I can't watch those kind of things or read those kind of books either. But you not know, all crime fiction is like that, is what I'm
Well, and
say.
I think for most people who write crime fictions, it's about the resolution. So it's not as much about the horror of the crime, because if you linger there too long, it becomes horror.
Right.
It's more about how do you resolve it and what happens along the way. So I think it's more creating the order in the world and restoring order through the solving of the crime than it is just this horror that you've created and then you don't have anywhere to go with it.
One of my early teachers was a horror writer, Dennis Etchison, and he says when all the horror writers get together, they're the nicest bunch of people you can ever meet. So I think there's some exercising of all this darkness, but you have to worry about the romance writers.
There is a question. Yes, ma'am.
Oh,
back here? Okay.
I'm curious about how a series gets started. Do you start writing a book going, this is going to be a series? Do you finish a book and go, it did really well, maybe I can do another one? How does that happen?
Well, I certainly did. No, in all seriousness, my first book, I knew it was part of a series. I mean, because that's what I was reading. You know, and again, as a voracious reader of mystery fiction, I was reading series after series. And from the reader's perspective, you're like, you can't wait for the next book. And that was the kind of reader I was hoping, you know, to find, someone that wanted the next one and the next one and the next one. you know, strictly for commercial reasons, it's a ticket to your next paycheck if you can sell it as a series too. So I'm always actually surprised when I hear people say, "Oh, I had no idea I was writing." So did you want to eat? You mean you gave no thought that they might want a second?
Well, but there are people who write nothing but standalone, so they jump off that bridge fresh every time.
Yeah.
That bridge is a lot more well-established if it's a series, and you know it's a series, and you create it designed to be a series, and if it's a standalone and they want something sort of like it.
Well, Mark, you're at the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, I don't write series books.
Yeah.
I read them. I like them, you know.
Yeah, I think for me in writing Charlotte Justice, I started out wanting to write about the period of time between the L.A. riots and the turn of the century. So there was a period of time that I wanted to cover. So I do that until I feel I'm satisfied with it. It's kind of like August Wilson with the 9 cycles of the play. He wanted to do something for every decade, and that's what he did. And when he was done, he was done.
Like Mosley with Easy Rollins, right?
Right, like Mosley. Or, you know, Sue Grafton, 26 letters, you're done.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I fall in that category. I didn't know I was writing a series.
Really?
And my first book took me 15 years.
Ah.
In terms of inception and actually writing it. And then so when Random House said, okay, we'll buy it, and the next we want two, and the next one is due the following year.
Yeah.
And it's like, but it all worked out.
Yes, ma'am.
First, my answer to the question, mm-hmm. I read mysteries in part because I see them as morality plays, and I like that. And I generally read series because I'm interested, particularly in different eras, and I like strong female characters.
Ah.
But... do you distinguish between mystery, detective, and crime novels? I'm just wondering because you
use them interchangeably.
Well, and particularly for me, I think of crime novels as something different than the other two.
I think the broader rubric is crime. It's all about crime. Detective fiction is amateur or professional, and then there are other, you know, other kinds of fictions and mysteries. I don't know. Mystery's always been a term that's been problematic for me.
I don't know. I found a copy of The Kite Runner at the mystery bookstore, and I said, you know, and they said, hey, you know, it's a kidnapping, and you know, if someone gets a parking ticket, that's a crime, you know. And so.
Plus, it's a bestseller, and it's going to sell, right?
Exactly.
I was only going to add to what you were saying about why I write and read mystery fiction. I think I approach it from the point of view of a woman, actually, that I am a woman living in an urban environment, and I'm constantly scanning my environment to see where and how I'm safe or I'm not safe. And sometimes sitting in these stories allows me to use a muscle in terms of scanning and figure out, yes, I don't need to be around that kind of a person. Or if I get in this situation, this is what I'm going to do. It's a way of, I don't know, making me feel oddly safer in that I'm learning how to decide which people are sociopaths and which people aren't sociopaths. So I was just going to add that comment.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the incredible novelist Attica Locke. When I saw her in the audience, I said, she's going to make it all about herself eventually.
Yes, sir.
Hi. Why do I read them? I read them because I want to meet a mind as sick as my own.
Ah.
And I do almost every time. Lahane, I don't mean the writer, I mean the characters. Thank you. I mean the characters. The ones that are getting me now are the David Peace novels, the Yorkshire Ripper series. Red Riding Quartet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where does it go from there? Because it always seems that a writer does something, somebody else has to do it worse or stronger.
Mm.
Not just a writer.
Sure.
But, you know, and I'm kind of fascinated, also as an aside on Lahane, who I think is a great writer. I was amused in one of the writer's magazines recently. He had an article reprinted about how his characters were not artificial, you don't do artificial characters or plotting, then I thought of Shutter Island, which is so artificial. I mean, what it is a rewrite of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And I can't read him anymore because I just found it so off-putting. On the other hand, when I found out that Anne Perry is an actual murderess from her childhood, I liked your books more. But where does it all go? What's next?
Well, that, I think that's an interesting question. It gets back to your comment, Mark, about serial killers. There have been a spate of novels that are just all serial killers. It's like, you know, if you pick up certain people, it's always going to be a serial killer, and it's always going to be more, the one is more dastardly than the next, et cetera. So
yeah, and
where do you put those?
You know, I don't know. I don't read those books anymore, really, because for me, there's like, you know, one, most murders are like crimes of passion, right? Someone makes you mad, you don't really think it through, and the next thing you know, you've got a body in the trunk. It's very rare that there are these people who love to kill people and get off on it, and they do it in really incredibly intricate ways and play cat and mouse games with the police. That doesn't really exist in real life. There are hundreds and hundreds of these people in books, and frankly, I just don't think it's healthy. It's a way to explain this, but it kind of belittles the power of actually taking someone's life and the consequence of that. This is basically the stuff I said earlier. I don't know where that's going.
This points out that, you know, when I first heard this woman's question about, you know, how can we live with ourselves if we write this kind of stuff, what that suggested to me is that as someone that doesn't read a lot of this stuff that we quote-unquote write, you're sort of lumping everything into one basket. In other words, the Silence of the Lambs is as completely different from anything the three of us write as you know, night and day. So there's all kinds of different types of crime fiction. The crime fiction, quote-unquote, is the big umbrella. Right. Okay, mystery means that it's a book that deals with generally a murder, and nobody knows who committed it, and you don't find out to the end. There's a question that has to be answered at the end. Crime novel, quote-unquote, like what Mark writes, by and large, doesn't care about answering that particular question. Mm-hmm. All kinds of other questions, but not who that. Did it, what was their motive, et cetera, et cetera. I'm the same as everyone here on the panel in saying that I hate books about serial killers that commit like horrific,
pornography.
It is pornography. It's sexual pornography. Yeah. And
it's not nearly as fun as pornography. Just putting that out there.
Okay. But there is something compelling about the serial killer story. I mean, I remember when I was covering The Night Stalker. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting.
I agree with that, but I think there's a way to write that story, and if you want to make a habit out of it, you can write it again and again without actually making a nightmare out of it every single time. Yeah. In other words, there are people writing perfectly terrifying thrillers with you don't see a single drop of blood on the page anywhere. They've found a way to tell the story that eliminates or at least shoves off stage, you know, all the really grotesque, sadistic elements of the serial killer story. The idea of where are we going, I think some people are bound and determined to push the button more and more and more, but I think the vast majority of people that write crime fiction, thrillers, whatever, are more interested in doing what Mark has said all along tonight, and that is examine the real-world ramifications of a single death, you know, as a result of violent crime.
I'm glad I'm not drawn to write those kind of stories, because the people who do, it's very interesting, their book signings, like what sort of people. No, I'm serious.
What they attract.
Yes.
No, I understand.
Maybe it's you.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, we've got time for a couple more questions. Okay.
So there was some discussion about the connection between those of you who have written for books for, you know, paper, and then writing for Hollywood or the television. My question is, I'm a idealistic American. I like to think we live in a meritocracy. I know we don't always, but how come I haven't seen any books of yours turned into movies? Because I've read a bunch of them, and they'd be great movies. So how does that work? Why do some things get turned into movies that are mediocre, and some things that would be great movies don't make it?
That's a different panel. That's a panel with several heads of studios and you asking them that question. We can't answer that. Can you?
Money. You know, obviously...
They can't meet your price. Is that it?
No, obviously that costs so much money to make a movie these days. It costs so much money to market it that they're not looking for anything that's original or interesting or challenging. They want they basically want Wonder Bread, because everyone loves Wonder Bread.
Right.
And, Wonder Bread, the movie.
Wonder Bread. Ryan Reynolds is Wonder Bread.
We have one more.
Helps you grow in 12 ways.
Right down here, sir.
What is it? The Wonder Years, right?
I kind of want to address the point she brought up earlier, the person before me, about how they avoided reading crime fiction. And I'm kind of a novice now to genre fiction. I love reading fiction in general. But I think the big thing that deterred me from reading genre fiction is it was brought up earlier that it's tends to be based around the stories, and it's about writing a good story. And I like reading a good story, but style is very important to me. I can't just read just something where it's like, oh, it's a nice story, but I need to read something that's also like just rich with like literary wordplay and things like that. And I mean,
and you don't think crime writers do that?
I think it's silly, but there's a lot of it. Like I'm coming across some like stuff like Jim Thompson stuff and things like that, and like that's really great, like literature, just like style, prose style. It's great. But my question is, like, how would you address somebody like me, who's kind of like a book snob, I guess you could say, and just try to get them to, like, embrace crime fiction and genre fiction in general?
Martin Cruz Smith.
Yeah.
That's who I would tell you to read.
There's a bunch of... You can look at David Mitchell's last book, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob Desote. It's a, you know, it's a crime story. There's a kidnapping and stuff like that. I mean, literally... It's good writing is good writing, and there's a lot of really good, stylish, you know, crime and thriller writers out there. You know, Ken Bruin, the Irish writer, has got a totally unique style. Elroy, he's no slouch.
Megan Abbott, The End of Everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Daniel Woodrow. Yeah.
Gar Haywood's Cemetery Road.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's all a good one.
Attica Locke, Blackwater Rising.
Yeah, so, I mean, but you do have to kind of sort through them. But it's just like shopping for any book, you know. Just pick it up in the bookstore and look at it, or pick it up on the online world store. Go up into the cloud and ask around. But just, you know, read the first paragraph or two, and if it seems like something that, you know, appeals to you, or it's well written or something, you'll know, and then try it out, you know.
Go to the library.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.